Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Coach Jay Smith from the University of Michigan, and you're listening to the Hoopheads Podcast.
Hey, Hoopheads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
One thing that I did that I've never done anywhere else, I guaranteed that we would play for a national championship by my third year. Because I felt that where Cuyahoga Community College was at, I thought I could build something special there.
Mark Anderson is the head coach of the Owensboro Thoroughbreds of the Basketball League. He has had 18 players that have signed internationally in the last 4 years from the minor league teams he's coached in the U.S. and Canada. Anderson won an NJCAA D2 National Championship at Cuyahoga Community College and was also named National Coach of the Year in 2004. He was an assistant coach at D3 Hiram College in Ohio from 2007 to 2010. Prior to his time at Tri-C, Anderson was the head coach at the University of Akron-Wayne College from 1997 to 2002. Anderson has worked the McCracken basketball camp since 1983 and has been the site director since 1995. He has also directed numerous youth camps throughout his career, as well as professional free agent camps since 2011. Mark has coached high school, JUCO, Division III, and minor league professional basketball. In 2019, Mark was the head coach of the Jamestown Jackals from the North American Basketball League, and in 2020, he became the head coach of the Owensboro Thoroughbreds of the Basketball League. Don't miss our Hoopheads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Make sure you check out our new Hoopheads Pod network of shows, including Thrive with Trevor Huffman, Beyond the Ball, the CoachMaze.com podcast, and Cavaliers Central with Justin Matcham, our first podcast dedicated to covering the ins and outs of an NBA team. We are unbelievably excited for the content we're going to be bringing you in the weeks ahead as more of our new shows come to life. If you've ever thought of hosting your own basketball-themed podcast or a pod that covers an NBA team, we want to hear from you about joining our great lineup of show hosts. Grab a notebook and get ready to learn as you listen to this episode with Coach Mark Anderson from the Owensboro Thoroughbreds of the Basketball League.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast Coach Mark Anderson. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, guys. Enjoy it. Looking forward to being on with you guys.
It's going to be a lot of fun to dig in. You have a wide variety of experiences in the game, and I'm really excited to be able to dig into those with you, find out more about each of the stops along the way in your coaching career and some of the different places that you've been, leagues you've coached in, levels you've coached at. Just really excited to dive into that. I want to go back in time, though, first to when you were a kid and just tell us a little bit about how you got into the game when you were younger.
Okay, well, I grew up in Northeast Indiana, outside of Fort Wayne. So, you know, basketball is huge over there, kind of like football is here, but everybody had a hoop in their driveway. You know, you get out, you shoot around, things like that. But my grandfather, Dave Herbst, was a professional back in the 1930s and early 40s. He played for the Fort Wayne Harvester team. And this was back when, you know, right at the end of the Depression and that, where guys would be hired and then given a job. So he kind of had that. I found out from my uncle this past week that he turned down a scholarship to go to the University of Illinois to play back in the early 30s. So he was a pretty good player. He ended up playing in the World Games in Chicago in 1939, 1940. And played against the original Harlem Globetrotters. So my one regret and all that is I never asked him about these things when I was growing up. I would go up to his lake and spend, you know, a week with him or so, And then, but basketball never came up. He never brought it up, but my mom would tell me things about him. So I was kind of intrigued, but, you know, again, growing up in Indiana, you were kind of expected to play. So we would get out and we would play. And it was that's probably about where it started.
And what was it about? You played all sports, I'm assuming, when you were younger compared to kids today who a lot of times specialize. So maybe just talk about your overall sports experience or your experience as a kid, because I think that's something that kids today miss out on.
I would agree with that. Yeah, we didn't specialize back then. You know, when it was football, we played football, whether it was tackle out in the schoolyard, baseball. These were the days when you'd have the mitt hanging on your handlebars and you'd drive around, you know, right around the neighborhood, and you didn't come in till, you know, it was dark. These things really did happen, and, you know, go and play baseball. That was probably my first real sport that I felt that I was good at was baseball, because I played that a lot because there's just more opportunity to do it as a team sport. But then as I started to get into junior high, I started to concentrate more on basketball, but I played all three sports.
So when you say you started to concentrate a little bit more on basketball, what did that look like from your development standpoint? Was that you playing more pickup games? Was that you getting in the gym or getting on the driveway, working on your game? Just what was it that you did when you started to focus a little bit more on basketball?
And this was before AAU, so this was the late 70s. So when we moved, when we went from New Haven, Indiana, out to Woodburn, we were out in the cornfields of Indiana, and my dad ended up building this basketball goal on the driveway. He had a 6x6 piece of lumber he put into the ground. He took a saw and cut out a backboard, and then just got the rim and the other brackets and put it together. You know, just going out there and playing. And we had a driveway that was kind of sloped, so you had to arc your shot. So I learned to have a good arc on my shot from being out there. And it was also a coated driveway, so when you would sweat or it would rain, it was pretty slippery. So we learned to have, you know, a good balance growing up with that.
Yeah, it's a lot different than it is today. I know hearing you talk about the brackets and the cutout wooden backboard, that sounds very familiar to me. That's the same thing that I had in my suburban driveway. My dad kind of was old school, so I had a wooden pole, I had some U-clamps, and I had a fan-shaped backboard that was cut out of plywood, and that was my basketball hoop from the time I was
really young. That's the exact same thing that we had.
Yep, and mine started out really low. My dad was maybe ahead of his time, and I was probably 7-8 years old, and my basket was probably 7 feet tall at the time. And just, I think I attribute a lot of my ability to shoot the ball over time to growing up, learning how to shoot it correctly, because I was always shooting on a lower basket when I was younger. And I wish more kids had the opportunity to do that today. That just doesn't happen nearly as much as it probably should have. Talk a little bit about your high school experience as a basketball player, maybe one or two memories for you that stand out as a high school player.
Well, I played for the same coach all 4 years. Freshman, I was on the junior varsity. And then the following year, he got the head coaching job at Woodland High School. And so my sophomore, junior, and senior year, I played for him. I ended up scoring over 1,000 points. This was pre-3-point line. And 44 straight games in double figures. I'm kind of proud of that one. It just meant I shot a lot.
Hey, you had to make a few there.
Yeah. But no, I ended up averaging 22 points a game as a senior and just under 9 rebounds a game. So we always got stuck. This was before class basketball in Indiana came about. So we would get stuck in the Fort Wayne sectional going against Southside or Fort Wayne Dwanger. I can remember, here I am, 6'1". Guarding Marty Seacrest, who's 6'6", or Greg Eifert, Tyler Eifert's dad, for the Miami Dolphins now, I think, or Jacksonville, or I think he was down there, tight end. His father, who was 6'8", played at Purdue. So we had no chance coming out of our sectional. So we knew it was pretty one and done. But the kind of the neat thing is we would play at the Fort Wayne Memorial Coliseum, and our conference tournament was held there. So I got to play three straight years in the Fort Wayne Coliseum, which is kind of cool. Seats 8,000, 9,000. It's where the Fort Wayne Pistons used to play in the NBA before they became the Detroit Pistons. So it's kind of a mystique thing to play in. And actually, that's where I scored my 1,000th point, was in my last game going in there. And that's pretty much what I remember about that. You know, I got a lot of good things out of playing high school sports and playing the different sports. I thought that helped me in basketball. I ended up playing volleyball my junior and senior year. It was a sanctioned sport. Ended up increasing my vertical jump. I had played football the previous 2 years and then went over to volleyball because I thought that would really help with my jumping and quickness and reflexes, and it did. It paid off.
At what point during your high school career did you start thinking about wanting to play sports in college? Because I know you also played some baseball, correct, in college? So you played some basketball and some baseball. So when did you start thinking about the opportunity to become a college athlete?
Probably towards the latter part of my sophomore year, I thought that this could be something that I could pursue at the next level, but not knowing at what level I could pursue it. But I knew that I was good enough, but just at what point or what level would I be at? And that was an eye-opener once I got there, once we get into that. But that's kind of why I went into coaching. But I knew early on that I could probably play. And then baseball, it was just the fact that, well, let's just see if I can, you know, walk onto a baseball team while I'm there in college and see. And it worked out. I played at two different colleges, baseball and basketball.
All right, so talk about the adjustment from high school, which is, I think, what you were hinting at.
Yeah.
Adjustment from high school sports to college sports for you, what that was like just in terms of the challenge that it presented to you when you first got to college.
Going from being a star to being a bench warmer, that was probably the most difficult thing for me, but I also was able to sit back. Now, mind you, I worked hard at what I was doing and you know, would make the starters or the guys ahead of me work because I could shoot the ball with the best of anybody. But that was probably about it at that level. But it was the fact that sitting back and watching what was going on, I think, and the fact that I always say that the reason I went into coaching is because I didn't get fulfilled as a player. And that void is what pushed me into coaching. And sitting back and watching how some guys did things that I liked and some things I did that I didn't like. And you know, I learned a lot in those 4 or 5 years of being in college, watching, being around the sports and playing basketball and baseball that I've put into how I do things.
So when you think about going into coaching, was it just that, had it been something you had thought about in high school and growing up, or were you still thinking of yourself strictly in playing terms at that point? And it was sort of once the opportunity to play began to get taken away that you started thinking about coaching, or had coaching always been on your mind from early on?
No, coaching wasn't. It was summer of 1983. So I was a sophomore in college and I started working the McCracken basketball camps, which I still work to this day. And it goes back to the founder of the McCracken camps was Branch McCracken, who coached at IU and won national titles in 40 and 1953. And the term Hurrying Hoosiers came from how fast that he picked the players at their pace of play. That's where the term Hurrying Hoosiers came from, was Branch McCracken's teams. When he passed in 1970, his son, David McCracken, took over. And it was my senior year in high school. My high school coach, Gay Martin, gave me a letter and said, "Hey, you might be interested in this." And I said, "Well, what is it?" And he goes, "I'm going to be in a counselor at a basketball camp." I said, "Oh, cool. All right. So, you know, I'll earn some money and do that and see what happens." Because my intent was to go in and get my business degree and just do like my dad was doing, be a salesman and whatnot for the rest of the time. So I call up Coach McCracken and I said, "You know, Coach, I'd like to work." And he goes, "Well, I'll tell you what, Mark, I'm full this summer." And this is when the camp was all outdoors. It was at Lake James up in Indiana. It was really hard to get in as a counselor if you didn't go to the camp, because they didn't know who you were, and I had never gone to their camps. So he says, "I'll tell you what. Next summer, you call me, and this time at this point next summer, you call me. I guarantee you'll be in." I said, "Okay." Well, I'm sitting in class one day. This was probably May of my senior year, and I get over the speaker for me to come down to the office. I said, "All right, I didn't do anything. Am I in trouble for something?" And no, here it was Coach McCracken. He was an adjunct professor at Bluffton. So he would drive from Fort Wayne to Bluffton. It was probably about an hour and a half drive or so. And this always stuck in my mind. He took the time to come to the high school off the highway, stop, get me out of class, and say, "Here's what I'm going to do. I guarantee that you're going to be in next year." And he was a man of his word. And that's the reason why, Mike, I still do that camp to this day, is the loyalty that he showed to me, as I've always returned that to him in that respect also. So 37 years of being with the McCracken camp. The only two summers I haven't worked it was 1987 when I graduated college, and 1989 when I got married. And then this summer, all the camps for that have been canceled because we're up in Michigan and Indiana because of the COVID-19.
That's an incredible story, just when you think about the fact that here was a guy that didn't know you from the next guy and yet took the time to invest in you and pour into you. And then clearly you've done the same in terms of giving back and wanting to be a part of that. What, beyond Coach McCracken himself, just talk to us a little bit about what makes the McCracken camps so special in your eyes. What keeps you going back? Other than that loyalty factor, I'm sure it's just the quality of what goes on. So just explain to us a little bit about what makes McCracken camp so special.
Well, it's always been hands-on, just from day one. You know, we just never, the motto is we don't roll out the basketballs. We don't play 5-on-5 for 4 hours a day and things like that. We teach the game. And that's where I've learned that side of basketball. He taught me how to teach the game of basketball in the way of fundamentals and things like that. And those are the things that I've always cared on. And we care about the kids. It's the overnight camp, so we make sure. The toughest job is being a counselor. I've been the site director for the last 25 years. So these guys that are the counselors, they got to make sure the kids are in their rooms every night. They're with them the 24/7 while we're there, 24 hours a day. It's no longer 7-day camp, but you know those things right there. We stay with the kids. We invest our time with the kids, and I think that's what brings. We would go streaks of 4 or 5 years of having the same kids coming back, because of the way we treat the kids, the game. They're not always the best basketball players, but I think because we showed interest and we were taking the time to coach them, and just like the kid who may be the best, we were still taking the time to coach the kid who may have the least talent out there, those types of things. And I think building the relationships are the things that I've learned from that also.
Yeah, that's so true. I wanted to ask you, as you were talking, thinking about my own camps here in Cleveland and just the way that the camp business and the way summer basketball has changed, obviously since the time you first started there at the McCracken camps, I would guess that probably the talent level or the ability level of the players today at camp are probably a little less than the talent of the players you got 15, 20, 25 years ago, just because the summer basketball scene has kind of shifted out from underneath the camp model and moved over to the AAU and playing games and tournaments all the time. Would you say that's probably an accurate description or no?
Oh yeah, that's spot on. I noticed that. Matter of fact, it's funny that you said that, because I was just talking to one of the counselors today about that. But the thing is that, yeah, I started to notice when, now, Ohio was one of the first states in the tri-state area to allow coaches to start working with their players during the summer. And once that started opening up, and then Indiana was the last of the three states, meaning Michigan, Ohio, and Indiana, where we primarily get all of our kids from. Indiana was the last one to really do that. And then once those three states started doing that, we saw a drop off initially in the numbers of kids. And then this is when the team camps at the universities started to take off, because now they had the time that they could invest 10, 12 days of working with their players, as opposed to not, you know, just open gym where you, quote unquote, weren't able to coach them and those types of things. So, yeah, I would say probably as far back as 25 years started to see that starting to change of the amount of the good players that you would have at camp. And actually seeing kids that are beyond sophomore now in high school is kind of rare to see at camp because of the AAU aspect.
Absolutely. I think that that's something that has definitely shifted. I know even for my camps, which are primarily focused on elementary school kids, used to be that I would get a lot of kids in that upper elementary grades of the fifth and sixth graders. And it seems that as time has gone on, I get less and less of those older kids, even within those lower grades. It seems like I get more of the first, second, and third graders now than I ever have, and less of the fourth, fifth, and sixth graders compared to what I might have done years ago. And there was definitely, I'm not sure that I can pinpoint the exact year, the exact time where it started to shift. But I do know that when I think about some of the quality of the games, for example, at camp from 15 years ago compared to the quality of games that we have today, it's not really comparable. And yet at the same time, I think that one of the things that I enjoy most about the camp is that a lot of the kids who do come are kids who maybe, I don't know if overlooked is the right word, or maybe they're just not into that system of AAU yet. But you're giving them something that there isn't a whole lot of it out there, because from a camp standpoint, I just think there aren't as many good quality camps out there as there used to be. I think previously, again, 15, 20 years ago, there were so many more camp options that had really good coaches and that were teaching the game and doing things correctly. Whereas now I think you have, because everybody's playing, and that's where the money is, and the youth basketball business is in running tournaments and having teams, you've seen a lot of people gravitate both from a coaching standpoint and from a playing standpoint. That's where people have gone. And so consequently, you don't have as many people getting involved in camp. But I still love just getting out on the court. And as you said, you mentioned it right off the top when you talked about McCracken camps, was just the ability to teach the game. And I think that is what I value about what I do at my camp. And I think you feel the same way.
Oh, absolutely. It's always interesting, because for the last 8-9 years coaching guys that are anywhere from 22 to 34 years old, and then going to the elementary kids and thinking, all right, I got to break it back down all the way down and go step by step. But, you know, I was telling some people the other day, that's good for me too, because, you know, sometimes I got to step back and say, all right, I've got to reteach the game. And that's good for me too, because it brings back stuff that maybe I skip over because I don't need to teach it at the level I'm at, but these guys need it. So it brings back a lot of stuff and that I've taught in the past, which I enjoy teaching because I can break it down and take the time, and because this is all new to them. So that's also, you know, exciting for me also, because you can see it in their eyes once they get it. It's like, oh, yeah, jab step. All right. Well, you know, a lot of times we see now that might not be the vogue thing to teach, but it's still a primary move that gets things done on every level. I think we've gotten to the point now we're overlooking the basic basketballs because we want to look flashy. We want to get those likes and everything on the social media rather than teaching the game. And this is an aspect where European basketball players are going ahead of USA basketball players in general because of their approach to the game. Now, we'll always have the best basketball players in the world, but when you get past the elite, now you've got some of these. I've been watching on usbasket.com how many European guys have been signed by colleges over here now. So, you know, that's becoming more and more of a thing. So as you look at this, we got to step back and start teaching the game more in the fundamental aspect of it. I think sometimes when we just get, you know, we think that's great that we're playing 100 games in 3 months during the summer, but what are we really getting out of that? That's the thing. You know, you're traveling, which is great. You know, you're playing, but are you getting any better? Are the guys, other than the elite guys, are the other kids getting better at this? And that's one of the things I think we got to really step back and look at.
Yeah, I think the challenge there is that when kids only play in games where there's a scoreboard, and when mom and dad are sitting in the stands, and when the coach is on the sideline and people are watching them, it's really, really difficult to try new things, to experiment, to get out of your comfort zone, to push yourself maybe beyond what you're capable of, because right. everything is being recorded, everything is being watched, everything is being critiqued. And that makes it really, really, really difficult. And so it becomes a challenge, I think, for kids to improve and add things to their game, because they never get a chance to just go in the gym and work on stuff by themselves. They don't get a chance to really get any good high-level practices, where even if you're in practice and you're quote-unquote playing, or you're using a games-based approach to practice, which a lot of us are using today, you still have a coach there who is trying to teach the game. It's not just an AAU game where 9 times out of 10, that's just 10 kids running up and down the floor, kind of playing glorified pickup basketball, but with a referee, with coaches, with parents in the stands. And it takes away all the good stuff from pickup basketball when you put all those other elements into it. And so it's a challenge. And I know I've been on my soapbox before here on the podcast that I really feel like the demise of playground basketball and pickup basketball for kids today makes me sad, because I just know how important that was to my development, both as a player and as a person, and developing strength of character and all these other different things that I think are so important that I learned by playing pickup basketball. And I think when you don't get an opportunity to do that as much, I don't think you can learn those same things in the AAU circuit. Now, you can learn different things, and there's certainly really good AAU coaches that are teaching the game and helping kids get better. But I think if you could somehow strike a balance between the two eras and get a little bit of each one, I think you'd have the best of both worlds.
It would be. And that would be because it's just like when you drive around, you see all these courts that are sitting empty in the cities, and the baseball, that nobody goes out and plays baseball anymore either. You know, it seems like that's almost a dying sport.
I was going to ask you about that when you were talking about baseball and having your glove on your handlebars, because I remember that too. And my question as we were talking, that it kind of got away from me, I can't remember, and I don't know if you can, the last time you drove by a baseball field and you saw 8 kids playing a pickup game of baseball, or in the yard or in a vacant lot. Like, I never, ever, ever.
I can answer that question, Mike.
Okay, Jason.
There you go. I'm here.
Here he is. Other sports always get him to jump in.
So I, for the first time last summer, was driving by the field down here over at Webster and Whitney. Kids were going to that new playground. You know that new playground they put in over there, Mike?
Yep, I know exactly. Yeah,
so I, for the first time, I want to say in 10 years, because I mean, I've lived in the same house my whole life, Mark, I saw 10 kids playing baseball on a field. And I'm not lying to you. When I said, Will, this is it. I said to my son, Will, I said, this is a rare sighting. It's almost as rare as seeing dinosaurs. Look at, there are 10 kids playing baseball that's not organized.
That's awesome.
And so that's the only time in the last 10 years that I've seen that many kids playing baseball. And I will say, this whole nonsense with the Major League Baseball isn't going to help their case right now. I'm just putting that out there too.
That's why I think it's a dying sport, because of what we've seen matriculating because of all this, and how, you know, they're arguing back and forth and how much pay they want and all that, rather than, and I know times are tough, but when we see these millionaires going back and forth like that, it doesn't help. It doesn't help. I mean, Major League Baseball is not doing a good job towards getting the youth involved like the NBA or like the NFL is in their game. We've got to do a better job with that.
Yeah, I would agree with you 100% there. I see baseball as a sport that has some huge challenges ahead of it. And I think one of the things that I also point to when it comes to baseball, I mean, there's a lot of things we could go into. There's the labor issues and the things that we're talking about here. Then I think there's the fact that for so long, the playoff games, the World Series games that used to be on during the day when we were kids, now on go late at night. The games are so long. Kids today, we know their attention spans are different. They're not going to sit and watch a four-hour baseball game. And baseball is a game of subtleties that if you don't understand those subtleties, you're not going to enjoy it or appreciate it nearly as much. And kids today aren't going to invest 4 hours in a baseball game to learn all those subtleties. And then I think the last thing is that you go and you watch a baseball practice as a parent and you watch your kids play baseball during a practice, and the level of activity that they get during a baseball practice compared to if they go and play basketball or soccer or lacrosse, which is becoming more and more popular. There's just so much more activity. You go to a baseball practice and let's face it, the only thing fun to do at baseball practice is to hit, right? That's what everybody wants to do.
Yeah.
And if you're lucky, you hit for 5 minutes during a practice, if you're lucky. And that's the fun part. And the rest of the time, a lot of time you're sitting around, maybe you're, you know, shagging some fly balls or whatever, but it's just not as fast paced and it's not as fun. And it takes a lot of investment to begin to appreciate what makes the game of baseball great. And I just think that the way our society is today is not necessarily conducive to baseball continuing to be popular. So it'll be interesting. 50 years from now, we can revisit this discussion and see where baseball is. All right, let's talk a little bit about after you get done with college.
Okay.
You end up getting into high school teaching and coaching. So talk a little bit about your very first experience where I know you were coaching multiple sports. So give us an idea of what that was like coming out into the real world and immediately becoming a coach at the high school level.
Okay. So my first coaching job was in 1987, junior high. And this was at the high school that I had graduated from. And I was thrown into the fire right away. And this call leads up to your question. But I had the head coach's son. I had another head coach's son at one of the bigger schools in Fort Wayne. I had the head football coach's son, and I had my brother on the team. So I had multiple eyes watching what I was doing, so I had to be on my game every time. But it was interesting, Mike and Jason, the only one that ever gave me trouble was my mom. She wanted to know why my brother wasn't playing more. The other three that were head coaches never intervened with what I was saying, and the fact of, you know, saying, oh, you need to do this, you need to play him, da, da, da. And now they would give me pointers and things like that, but I always thought it was great. They let me learn on my own. So I was a junior high coach for 3 years, and then I got my first teaching job in 1989 at Westview High School up in Topeka, Indiana. It's outside of Elkhart, Shipshawana area. If you ever go through there on the turnpike on your way to Notre Dame or Chicago, you go right by it.
Elkhart, home of Sean Kemp.
Yeah, I was going to say that, but I know if people would remember him, but I missed coaching against him by 1 year. He graduated in 88. So, but I did coach against Brad Miller, who played a long time in the NBA. He was at East Noble High School in Indiana. But so I ended up coaching basketball, baseball, volleyball. And became, at one point, I was a head coach of all three of those sports in the same year. So I sat back at one point. I go, wait a minute. I'm coaching 48 out of 52 weeks. I go, this isn't going to work. So I gave up baseball and had volleyball for one more year and gave that up and then just concentrated on basketball. But here's the interesting thing. So Topeka and Shipshawana, the community at the time, was probably about 2,000 to 3,000 people. And the high school, when I was there, had about, I would say, at max 350 people. But our gym was built in 1990, had 18 baskets, 92 it was built, 18 baskets in it, three full courts, and had 3,400 seats. And for a community, like I said, less than 3,000. And we would get upwards, if we were playing our rival Lakeland or Fairfield or Goshen High School, we would get close to 3,000, 3,200 in there. And that wasn't unusual for that time period. And this was before class basketball was in Indiana in the tournaments.
And I can recall when I was a varsity assistant there, we went against Lee Nalon and South Bend Clay when they ended up, he played in the NBA, he ended up winning the state championship in Indiana. We played before 8,000 people in Elkhart Central at 10 o'clock in the morning. And then we beat Fairfield, one of our rivals, and had to go back in that evening and play South Bend Clay. And we ended up losing to them by 4. If we would have won that, we would have gone to regionals, and I think we had a good chance to go to semi-state that year with the team that we had. We didn't have anybody over 6'3". Our front line was 5'11", 6'3", 5'11". Their front line was 6'6", 6'9", and 6'8". So,
good luck matching up with that.
Well, I remember after the game, we got home and I popped in the VHS because I go, I know we had a chance to win this game because we lost by 4. Between the end of the third quarter and beginning of the fourth, we had gone 10 straight trips where we didn't score. And that was the ball game right there.
Yeah, that makes it a little tough. All right, let me ask you this about high school basketball.
Sure.
If you had your preference, would you, if you could set the system up any way you wanted it to, would you still set up a classless system, or do you prefer to have the schools divided by size? If you could set it up in an ideal world, which one of those systems would you prefer?
Well, I grew up where there wasn't class and played through it and coached through it. And I always thought that that was great. I see the benefits of both. But I would say you probably got to go to the class, but you can't get ridiculous with having like 6-7 classes like some of the states have. I don't know. I don't remember how many are in Indiana now because I had left Indiana in 96, 97, and then it came in 97, 98. So, but not many of the small schools ever beat the big schools, but it became interesting when it would get close. And there was always that. I think it was the thrill of, and again, people who didn't grow up in Indiana really didn't get the movie Hoosiers. We thought it was great. But, it was that thrill of going up against, David and Goliath. And sometimes David would win. And that was the cool thing about it. But I also get the class basketball, going down to the Columbus and watching it down there is always great basketball.
Yeah, there's definitely pluses and minuses, I think, to both systems. The chance for that monumental upset in a classless system always has that sort of romantic feel to it that, wow, when that small school jumps up and beats their big school rival or somebody that isn't expected to get beat, I think there's a lot to be said for that. And yet when you have a class system, you're obviously evening out the playing field in a lot of ways. And then you're also providing an opportunity for more teams and more kids to finish their season with a victory, which is always a positive as well. When you think about, again, what the purpose of high school sports is all about, to be able to have kids have that kind of positive experience, I think is a good one. And you can, I think if you execute them well, you can probably get a lot of value out of both systems. So you leave Indiana and you eventually make your way to Cleveland. Talk a little bit about how that transition happened.
Well, my wife's from Strongsville, so that was the big reason. But so going back to the South Bend Clay story, that was 94. So the head coach retires from coaching. I get the job. So we were a senior-laden team. So the next year, I think I only had 2 of my 10, 11 guys that actually had varsity experience. So we go 11-11, and then the following year, it was like disaster. We ended up 9-12. And then in that system where they won, 60, he won 80% of the games that he coached in, and they weren't happy with him. Well, if I win less than 50%, are they really going to be happy with me? So I resigned with air quotes, and I had an interview set up in Indianapolis. And this was, again, one of the things that played into how bad that year was in Indiana in 96. So my wife's father passes away in May, actually right on Mother's Day of 96. And I got an interview in Indianapolis. He says, well, I think we're going back to Strongsville. I said, okay. So I got an opportunity, and this mic was something. It was called the Golden Opportunity to the University of Akron. They brought in seven of us for a graduate study to get a master's in secondary education administration, and then they also gave us a stipend. I think it was like $12,000 or $14,000. And paid for our master's degree. So I got my master's done in 1 year and had the opportunity to go out and into the field and around Northeast Ohio and then observe student teachers. And in part of that, I saw that there was an opening at the University of Akron Wayne College down in Oroville. And I've been out of basketball for a year. So I thought, well, all right, let's see what happens. I'll send in my resume and go from there. I ended up getting that job, and then the following year, I got hired and also to teach at Cleveland Central Catholic. So I would drive from Brunswick to Cleveland to Oroville to home, you know, throughout the basketball season for the next 5 years. So it was good. I got to build a college program from the bottom up. I did everything there. I had assistants, but the thing was that, you know, we were all part time, so everything was on each of us to do the different things. So, you know, in that respect, I learned a lot of things. We increased the budget. We ended up averaging 17, 18 wins my last 3 years there. So we turned the program around. It's in the ORCC, the Ohio Regional Campus Conference. And it's good basketball. It's just a lot of times it's overlooked. People don't really take it as being college basketball, but it is. And it's a good experience.
What were one or two things that you learned from that experience that you still carry with you today in your coaching?
Oh, that's a great question. One or two things from that I had to time management. Was very crucial because of all the driving and where I had to be, logistics, and then being prepared. So time management and preparation it had to be spot on every time. And that's the two things. My practices, I could give you a practice plan if you came in, a practice script, and we will hit everything on there at the exact same time unless I don't like how they're doing something or it's going really well and I'll give them a little extra time. But everything is in order, what we're going to do, when we're going to do it. And those were the things that I learned that from the other. You know, I always look at there's three coaches that really influenced my basketball. But that's some of the things that I learned from them. But I think the thing, going back to your original question, the logistics and the being organized.
So how did you manage your time in terms of doing all the prep work and the things that were required for you from you as the head coach of a college basketball team while you're during the day teaching at a school, which clearly sometimes if you're the basketball coach at the school, you may be afforded some time during the day to be able to think about basketball or have an extra planning period or things like that that we've seen for other coaches, but for you, obviously that wasn't the case because you weren't coaching at Cleveland Central Catholic. So Just talk to me a little bit about what your day was like, how you went about planning for practices, preparing for games. Just how did you manage that time? I'm just curious.
So a lot of my prep time, I would usually have two during the day. One, I would get the things I needed for the classes that I was teaching. And I taught like four different things throughout the day, so I had to juggle that too. And then one of them would be, you know, I would have to get practice typed up and then have it printed out to watch films. Anytime I could sneak it in there, at home if I could sneak it in there, those types of things. So it was, like I said, I had to be... time management. And then to recruit, I started just making up different like postcards, sending them out to the different schools in the area or down around Oroville and that, and doing it a lot of that way because I couldn't get out to see everything. So that was the way that we did it there. And it worked. I mean, we had our guys you know, to this day, I still keep in touch with a lot of them. One's now a principal that played for me down there, a couple others that gone into coaching. So it was a good experience.
When you finish there, then you get another opportunity to continue at the college level, and you get to go to Cuyahoga Community College. How does that happen? How do you get that interview? Just describe for us how you get to that job and what the interview process was like for you to get to Tri-C.
That was because we had played them home and away for a couple of years, and the athletic director, Dan O'Connor, who's now in Alaska as a president at a community college, he called me out of the blue one day. He goes, "We have an opening. Would you be interested?" I said, "Sure." And we got to talking. He liked how my teams were organized, how I went about it on the sidelines. And it was a perfect fit because Central Catholic was only 5 to 7 minutes away from Tri-C Metro campus. I thought, man, this would be great. This would cut down a lot of driving and, you know, a lot of things I could get done during the day now and be prepared and just, it'd be a lot easier. And it ended up, so we were in, that was 2002. We had gone from Chicago. My mom and dad had their 40th anniversary up there. And we drove to Orlando to see my cousin who works at Disney. So we got to get into Disney for a pretty good price. And then driving back, and he calls me and says, you know, I wasn't the first choice. So I said, okay. He goes, but the person who we want doesn't want, he's asking for a little bit too much on what we can give him. He goes, would you still be interested? I said, yeah. He goes, can you be in here tomorrow? I said, I'm in South Carolina right now, but I'll do my best. I said, yeah, I'll get there. So I ended up having a second round in there and talking and going through a second round of interviews. And the one thing that I did that I've never done anywhere else, I guaranteed that we would play for a national championship by my third year. And because I felt that with where Central, where Cuyahoga Community College was at, and the players that I had in class at Central Catholic, I thought I could build something special there. And it turns out that we were able to. Now, my first year there, we went 10-16. But the thing I was most proud of that year, we only lost one guy out of 14 to grades. Because JUCO gets a bad rap, and you know, everybody thinks, guys go there because they don't have the grades. That's not the reason why guys play JUCO, especially in a metropolitan area. It's because a lot of times they're overlooked. And that was the thing that I found, is that I assembled, we and my assistants, Ornette Gardenhire and Ray Smith, we were able to put together a pretty darn good team of guys that were overlooked in the Cleveland area.
So what was the biggest difference from your experience at Wayne when you go to the JUCO level? What was different about it that maybe what were some challenges? What were some things that you immediately liked about it? Clearly, the ability to find overlooked recruits was key to your success. But just talk a little bit about maybe the differences between being the coach at University of Akron-Wayne versus being at Tri-C.
Speed of the game. You know, that's, you look at every level, Mike, that's the biggest difference, the speed of the game. It's not necessarily the skill difference. In many cases, it could be. But when you look at it, guys can shoot at all the levels. Guys can really handle the basketball at all levels. Guys can defend. The difference is the size and the speed. And that's what it comes down to. Like I said, I still remember my first year at Tri-C, and we're going, and the guys are on the court going, "Coach, come on, call the play." It's like, "Oh yeah, I know, it's moving fast." All right, so you know, that's the one thing I had to get used to, is the speed of the game, and it does. And you know, everybody always adjusts, but that was the thing. And I had you know, bigger guys to that I could go get. That was nice. We could pay for books and tuition. We couldn't pay for housing, so we had several scholarships that we could divvy up amongst the guys. So that was good in that respect.
Was it a challenge again to be the head coach at that level and not being able to dedicate yourself full time during your workday to the basketball part of it. How did you go about dealing with that as you went through your 5 years at Tri-C?
That was a lot of it was the connections made through the different players that we had. My assistant coaches had always been in the Cleveland area, so that was huge. So their names were known, so that helped. The funny thing is that after we won the national championship and then went back the following year to the Final Four, the next few years, the only reason I was there for 5 years, guys didn't want to come play anymore. I mean, I would say, you know, we just won the national championship. I can still remember being on the phone with a local kid, and I said, I can get you the opportunity to be seen by Division One, definitely Division Two, because all of our starters went either Division One or Division Two after that. He goes, no, I'm not interested. I was kind of like, wow, okay. So that was kind of what we were up against at that point, is that guys in the Cleveland area, they didn't want to come to Tri-C. Now, Mike Duncan, who was my starting point guard on that national championship team, is now the head coach there, and he's doing a tremendous job. He's really put together an outstanding career coaching there. And one of the things that he has that I didn't have is a wood floor in there. We had that tartan, that rubber surface.
I remember that well. I played down there a lot.
Yeah, and that was part of the reason why guys didn't want to come. And I can remember coaching on that and then going home. My knees would be hurting, and I could just imagine how the guys felt, you know, going up and down that court for 2 hours a day and jumping and coming down on it. So, but those were some of the things that, well, once the guys didn't start saying, you know, I don't know if I really, when the recruiting became tough there, I thought, all right, I'm going to look for something else. So, because I'm not going to bang my head against this after, you know, what we put together here, and then people aren't going to recognize it.
Yeah, it's tough. I think that it's one of the things that you run into, and I think it maybe it's unique to Cleveland, but that's where the majority of my experiences have been. And I think about even Cleveland State, and my dad, when I was growing up, was a professor at Cleveland State, so I grew up going to games at Woodling Gym all the time, and seeing the Kevin Mackey era and watching them get to play David Robinson and Navy back in 86 and looking like they were going to be poised to really turn that program into something that could, you know, be one of those mid-major powers as time went by. And of course, then Coach Mackey had his situations and things ended up going south, but they built the Wolstein, what's now the Wolstein Center.
Right.
There just was, but I remember, I just always felt like there was a challenge in getting kids to commit to that kind of urban campus.
Right. Where,
at least back in the day when I was a kid, Cleveland State had pretty much one dorm. Now it's a little bit different now. They've certainly built up the campus. There's a lot more housing and opportunity for kids who are attending Cleveland State to be part of a campus life. But back then, there was Viking Hall, and that was a converted Holiday Inn, and there were maybe right. 500 students living in there. And I think that was probably a similar challenge to what you ran into, is what they ran into at Cleveland State, is it's just difficult to, I would think, recruit kids to those kinds of environments where you don't necessarily have that campus feel that, again, that doesn't necessarily appeal to every potential college basketball player, because there's a lot of guys that grow up in the city that want to continue to remain in the city.
Right.
But still, it's definitely, I'm sure, it was a challenge that you ran into occasionally.
Oh, yeah. And now they have like apartments right across the street from the Tri-C gym and things like that weren't there 15 years ago. That's really helped with them with the recruiting. And even back when we had the success, and even Mike's teams now, I'm not sure how many – we didn't. Cleveland State wouldn't even come over and look at our guys, even though we had one go on and play at Rhode Island, who's still playing professionally in Poland now. So I don't know. You know, it's just one of those things. That relationship was never really built between those two schools, and it should be, because being right there next to each other virtually.
Yeah, it's interesting. You never know what the behind the scenes things are that go on and why those connections aren't built, whether it's a personal relationship between the coaches or just cooperation between the schools or who knows what it is. And I think you see that on all levels of basketball in different areas that in a lot of ways, even on the youth basketball side, it's become very provincial and territorial in a lot of places.
Oh, yeah. Where,
you know, you see that cooperation might end up being the better route for everybody. And yet people kind of try to, I think a lot of times, hunker down. And so I think that's a little bit of what you're seeing. So you talked a little bit about how you started to look around and think about a different opportunity. And that opportunity comes to go and coach at the Division III level at Hiram, but you go from being a head coach to being an assistant coach. Talk a little bit about what that transition was like, going from being the guy who's making all the decisions at the, as the head coach, to a guy who is now making suggestions rather than those decisions.
Right. So it was, again, it was an eye opener. And I knew that going in that, all right, not everything that I'm going to say or want to do is going to be accepted, and that's okay. And Steve Fleming was the head coach at the time, and he reached out to me out of the blue. He called me on a Sunday and asked if I wanted to come out and talk about it, and I did. And he was putting together a staff. So not only was I the only head coach on there, Mike Marcinko had been a head coach at Hiram and local high schools around here. He's now the girls coach at Independence. And then we had another head coach on there also. So there was three head coaches in under Steve. And so it was, I thought we had the best, one of the better staffs assembled around, but you're in the same conference with Worcester and Wittenberg and Ohio Wesleyan. And at the time Wabash was pretty decent. So you were looking up at those guys and trying to, you know, get into the tournament and play. And that was always difficult. And Hiram's out there quite a ways from any major city. So that was also kind of tough in recruiting out there also, you know, trying to get into Cleveland, trying to go to Youngstown, go into Akron and get guys to come. And we could, you know, some of the packages that were offered in the way of financial aid were very lucrative and it worked out for many. But again, you're always up against Worcester and Witt and those teams. So it was difficult out there. So after about 3 years of that, and a lot of times as a head coach, you thought, well, I would have done this. And that's not the reason why I left, but it was just getting frustrated at seeing, man, I want to be in charge again. You know, it's one of those things. Not that I have to be in charge all the time, but it was one of those things I was just itching to get back as a head coach.
All right, so that sets you off on an odyssey.
An odyssey, you got it.
of professional basketball. So I'm not even going to attempt to go through
stop
by stop. I want you to just kind of give us an idea of how you got involved in this, I'm going to just say, minor league professional basketball world, and then just kind of take us through the different travels, stops, experiences that you've had, and the people that you've been able to interact with as a result of kind of being in this world that I'm not sure a lot of coaches, a lot of people who are in basketball even are familiar with some of the places and leagues and things that you've been associated with. So just kind of walk us through. I think this is an interesting career path that you've been able to take that not a lot of people are aware of.
Yes. Well, I started with the Universal Basketball Association, the UBA. So it was up here and we had four teams in the Cleveland area and we would play round robin. And then we went to Atlanta. We had the best team. So we ended up going to Atlanta to play in the league playoffs. And the teams down there were pretty stacked because they had a lot of Division I guys, former overseas pros. So I was there for a year. And then the Lima Express was in the PBL, Premier Basketball Association, Premier Basketball League. So you even got me, Mike. I can't even remember all the letters. But that was a good experience because in those 3 years in Lima, we were able to put 15 guys overseas and in Canada. And one of the things that's one of the things I'm proud of is that we were able to get guys to pursue their dreams. Like Justin Mance, he ended up playing for us in two different segments, over two years, but he got to go into the G League. He got to go overseas. He's a 7-footer that played at Kent State. So we had a lot of mid-major guys that came through Lima, and we played at Lima Central Catholic, which has a pro-length court. And it's a really great facility over there in Lima. I don't know if you've ever been in it, but very nice. So we were there for 3 years. And again, the constraints, and we don't do minor league basketball very well here in the States the way they do in Europe, because there's a lot of guys that are out there that scam players for money and then don't follow through, those types of things. Sometimes owners get in over their head, not on purpose, obviously, but they look at it and think, oh, I can do this. But then once the bills are due, it's like, oh, okay. So that's why we have, a lot of leagues fold. The league that I was in with Lima, that's what happened. I mean, as much as Lewis was doing everything that he was doing great, it just came down to the finances that he couldn't do it. And we all understood that. But then that opened the door for me to go to Canada in the Canadian Basketball League. Butch Carter, who was the coach of the Raptors back in the late 90s, 2000s, ended up hiring me to come in and coach the Hamilton team, the Hamilton United team in the greater Toronto area. And this was a great experience. And being in Canada was wonderful. The people are great up there. It's expensive living, but we played FIBA rules. So that was interesting. That was my first time being involved with that. And the aspect of that, what I like, is that only the coaches can call timeout. So you can't have players falling out of bounds, calling timeout, wasting one there, and things like that. So that was a good experience. And I like how fast the game moved, because it was the 10-minute quarters, players get 5 fouls, those types of things. So that was enjoyable. Most of our team up there was American, and it was always interesting when we'd be out in the community and talking with people. As soon as we would say a couple words, oh, you're from the States, because of our accent. So it was a good experience up there. It was only for a year. Again, it was one of those things that the teams just financially, you had some playing in arenas and colleges, and the cost up there is just so much more than it is here. So that didn't work. So then I came back here, was looking, didn't find anything. Started working at the Brunswick Rec with Mark Whitus with the Junior Cavs program. And then once he went in a different direction, I took over and was directing that for the spring. And that was one of those experiences, Mike, where I had to step back. I was coaching the coaches and coaching the kids. And it was a great experience, because we played USA rules, USA basketball rules with the no zone. I gave them one offensive play and then taught them 5 out. And our substituting patterns were set in stone. So we didn't have any problems when it came to, well, he's playing more than my son, and this, that just didn't go on. And I would referee every game during a time period each weekend, so they would see me there. And it was a great experience. We had great people that were coaches. We had guys that would come in and referee. It was a good experience in learning that and taking basketball back down to its grassroots, and had second and third graders and teaching them the game of basketball. It was a good experience. From there, the new league that was formed, the Basketball League. It was Dave Magley, who was a former Cleveland Cavalier. He was an Indiana Mr. Basketball in 1978. I remember him. He's about 4 years older than me. So I do remember him playing. He played at Kansas.
Do you remember who he got drafted with the Cavs? Do you remember the famous saying?
Oh, yeah. I just saw it the other day. It's Bagley, John Bagley.
John Bagley, the Bagley and Magley duo. I still remember that vividly.
Yep, Bagged and Mag.
Basketball. That's funny.
Yeah, Mag.
I've never heard of either of those guys, and I'm a huge Cavs fan, so there you go.
You're too young.
Oh, you never heard of John Bagley?
I was born in 86. I was born in 86, Mark.
You got to do some history. You gotta,
all right,
you
gotta, I was just leaving college history. Then, Jason. But no, Dave Magley, his claim to fame is that he's the worst draft pick that was ever taken by the Cavaliers. And he makes fun of that. But the fact that he's given guys the opportunity and to go and earn a living, we're not semi-pro. All of our guys are, I don't even use that word because once you get paid, you're a pro. But none of our guys have to work a second job because they're paid enough. Their housing is taken care of. They get meal money on the road. And we've got probably the best owner in the league with Chris Allison, who lives down in Columbus. The team that I'm coaching this past year was Owensboro. But let me go back to that first year in the PBL. So I'm up at Jamestown, New York, about 2.5 hours from here, and it's about an hour and a half south of Buffalo, and about 45 minutes east of Erie. So coached there for a year. We missed the playoffs by a game. We had a winning record. So for only the second time in 20-some years of coaching, I'm fired. And that I handled this one much better because I know it's a business. And then Chris calls me and we talk. And then I end up down in Owensboro. But let me go back to the Canadian experience. What was really cool about that is that here I had Butch Carter, who coached the NBA, would call me after games and give me pointers on what he saw because our games were streamed on TV up there. And we would have conversations about, you know, where could we improve? What could I have done better? I would ask him some things about doing this against this, asking me, you know, I would ask him things. So that was a wonderful experience there, is that I got to talk with a guy who was actual NBA coach of the year, coached guys at the highest level.
Absolutely. Butch is such a bright guy. He's been such an advocate for us on the podcast, and we've been fortunate enough to have him on. And he actually, when he was coaching back at Middletown, he coached one of my former teammates down at Ken, who was only with me for his freshman year and then left midway through his sophomore year and transferred to Miami, Greg Derbyshire, who runs pro camps now, which got started back with Butch. So there's all these, it's amazing the connections. Then obviously we've had your former boss, Lewis Shine. We had Lewis on the podcast, and he's been great with us too. It's incredible how small the basketball world really is. It's incredible to me.
Well, and through all this, another guy in Columbus, Don Sellers, who actually got me into the work in the NBA G League national tryouts back in Chicago and then 2 years in New York. So I got to meet Bob McKinnon. So I got a good rapport with him. Through Don, I've met Jim Clements, where I've sat down and we've talked about the triangle offense. He gave me some pointers. Now, a lot of coaches, they don't like the triangle. They think it's outdated, but you don't have to run it every time down. You can use aspects of it. And then through Don, I've also met and talked with Craig Hodges, and he gave me some pointers about the triangle offense. So it's kind of cool that through all this, you like said, it's such a small world, and going out to Vegas and doing some of these camps and combines that I've done around the U.S., I've got to meet some very interesting people. And I think that's the biggest thing that I take out of this, is that building these relationships, not only with players, I still keep in touch with students and players I coached back in the early 90s. And then the guys that I've coached on the pro level, there's a few of them that are still out and about playing overseas, which is cool to see. And then now in the TBL, how we're opening up markets. I'm supposed to go down to Dallas in a couple weekends to be a guest speaker and a coach for a summer league down there with one of our teams. But as we've seen with what's going on, you know, the Dallas right now is one of the big breakout areas. So we'll see where that goes. But the thing is that the relationships that are being built over this time period are the things that I cherish the most about this game of basketball.
All right. I have two questions. First of all, I want to ask you just about all these different stops that you've had in this professional basketball odyssey. Did you always maintain your home base back here in Cleveland and then just sort of fan out to the different locations that you've been, or did you pack up and move to the places where you were coaching?
No, I moved there. Well, let's step back, Mike. The only way I was going to do this is if my wife was agreeable to this. So,
understood. You better have a good wife and an understanding wife if you're going to do all this stuff.
Right. We've been married 31 years, and she's a teacher and coach too. So I knew that, you know, that once our kids were grown and out of the house, it would be a little bit easier to start doing these things. That's one reason also I waited so long to try to do something like this, because I knew it would be a little bit easier. So yeah, so I would live during the season, I would live at the places where I was coaching. Jamestown, 2.5 hours after a Sunday night game, I'd come back so we wouldn't practice on Monday, and I'd go back Tuesday afternoon. Owensboro, 6.5-7 hours, and I couldn't do anything there, so I had to stay down there full time. So once the season started, and of course, we were cut short this year because of the outbreak. But we probably have the best arena, one of the better arenas the best in our league, the Owensboro Sports Center. And if Yakima comes back in next year like they're supposed to, they have the Sun Dome, which is kind of cool to play out there in. And, you know, and traveling. So when I was at Jamestown, one weekend, we flew to Seattle. Had to get in vans, drive to Yakima, drive back to Seattle where we were staying. That was 2.5 hours. Get up at 4, get on a flight to fly to San Diego, play in San Diego, get up the next morning at 4 again, fly to Vegas, drive up to Mesquite, play at Mesquite, drive back, took the red eye back to Cleveland. Got in at like 5:30 in the morning, and then they shuttled us back to Jamestown. So, yeah.
That's some serious travel. All right. So that leads directly to my next question, which is how many teams are currently in the basketball league, and what's the vision, what's the plan as you understand it for that league?
All right. So we have 15 teams. And there's kind of like a pod set up now. There's going to be, in New York State, there's three teams in Jersey, so you can count that as New York. Then there's two in Florida. North Carolina has one. We're in Kentucky. Indiana will have two. Ohio has two with Dayton and Columbus. Dallas area has two. Little Rock's coming in. And we're hoping that Yakima comes back along with Mesquite and San Diego. So the long-term vision is to put teams back in markets that once had a CBA team or a G League team, that is, because now all the G League teams are trying to get within 45 minutes to an hour from their parent teams, which makes sense if you're going to have two-way players. And you want to send guys back and forth. It only makes sense to have them that close. So the long-range term would be to get probably this year 15, 16 teams. The following year, add another 4 or 5, so 20. Just keep building it like that.
That's really cool. I think that it's something that, like I said off the top of this part of the pod, that not a lot of people really know or understand what's going on with professional basketball on that minor league level and just how many guys still love the game and want to continue to play. And obviously it affords coaches an opportunity to be able to continue to coach in different types of situations and all different kinds of players that come through there. What's the part of that experience? And again, you don't have to narrow it down to one team or one league or one situation, but just overall, when you look at that whole entire professional basketball experience, what's the one or two things that really stand out for you that you love about being involved with professional basketball at those levels?
Helping guys attain their dreams, giving them the opportunity to continue, because their window of playing is going to be 10, 12 years tops. I mean, I can coach another 14 years till I'm 70, which is my goal. So that would have put me in the game somewhere around 40, almost 50 years of coaching. So the thing that I like is that giving the guys the opportunity, one of the questions I'm always asked, isn't it difficult to coach guys at that level? And I know, because they know if they're going to be knuckleheads, they're not going to get the opportunity to move on, because no one overseas is going to bring in a knucklehead. You're not going to have that opportunity. So I've been blessed to have guys that are, that's one reason why we've moved so many guys over the last two, I think I've 15 in Lima and in the previous teams. So I'm somewhere around 20 some guys in that time span, and giving them opportunities to go overseas. Now, once they get there, it's up to them. But I think it's, you know, it's enjoyable to see these guys have that dream, that put in the time. And there's a lot of work that goes into it. Again, like I said, we're not semi-professional. We're pros. And the amount of time that these guys put in that's unseen, the weight training on their own, they're going and putting up shots on their own. You know, they don't have to, they cannot rely on somebody else to say, hey, let's go do. No, they've got to have the impetus to do that themselves, because they know they're one phone, we're all one phone call away from being removed at that level. But the thing is that they know that somebody's right there if they're not going to do the extra work.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to add, what makes the basketball league different than a lot of these other leagues is the amount of community work that we do. Like Owensboro, we did so many things. We would go into elementary schools, Mike and Jason, and we would have the whole gym for us. And I was amazed. You know, we'd go in and talk for 25, 30 minutes. And sometimes it would go over an hour because the kids kept asking questions and they wanted, you know, they weren't trying to get out of class, but I could, you know, being a teacher, I would look at teachers, I would say, I could see that they were like, okay, this has gone long enough. We got to get back into class. And we would have to cut it short, but we 4 or 5 schools where it was an all school assembly for a minor league basketball team. And these guys would come out, the guys that I'd have with me were so good at talking with the kids and getting behind the microphone, and we would exchange stories with the kids, and then I would take the microphone into the stands and we would have question and answer, and it was a great experience. And that's one of the things that I think sets our league apart from some of these other ones.
Yeah, I would think so. That probably, I would guess, is not a priority for every single place that you go when you do put that into it. And I think it goes to one of the themes that's run through our podcast is using basketball to help to teach life lessons and have a positive impact. And in a lot of cases, we're talking about having a positive impact on the players within your team. But you're talking not only about that, but you're also talking about being able to have a positive influence on the community around you. And I think when you can pay it forward and use the game in that way, to me, that really is what coaching and teaching and just all of that is all about, is really trying to have a huge impact on the people around you, and then getting to use the game of basketball, which we all love, as the vehicle to be able to do that is especially rewarding. And that goes to my next question, which is, how do you go about helping a player who, let's say you have somebody on your team who has aspirations for playing overseas, you feel like as their coach that they have the capability of doing that, what type of contacts have you built up? What kind of help can you give a players in that situation?
Well, our games are live streamed. That's huge. That helps. We use a thing called Sportscaster, and it's out there where the games are there. The other thing is through agents, the combines that we have. I know I get contacted from a lot of, through LinkedIn, I get a lot of contacts from that overseas asking me about the players. So that's one of the things. And our stats are legit. Our stats for the league are updated. We're on the Genius Sports, which is FIBA certified throughout the world. That helps. So teams overseas can look at it and say, oh, all right, now we can compare it. Our league is up on usbasket.com so that everybody in the world can see what's going on with our teams, our rosters. So those types of things, those right there have helped.
What do you see for yourself moving forward as you look to, you said you have about 14 years more of coaching, hopefully. When you look out over across those 14 years, what do you see yourself doing in those next 14 years with the game of basketball? Do you see yourself staying in the professional ranks? Do you see yourself wanting to, at some point, maybe go back to college, maybe do some things with camps? Just talk to me a little bit about what you foresee in your future.
Yeah, over the course of those 14 years, when it starts to wind down towards the end, I don't necessarily have to be a head coach, but maybe being on somebody's staff and helping a young coach at a college level, at a pro level. Again, one of the things that I guess that I've seen at this level is it's difficult to advance without a huge break. But sometimes you never know when that's going to come. And I think that's one of the things that keeps me going. I've had other people ask me, you know, why you keep doing this? Say, well, you never know. I mean, it's one of those things that something could come along and who you're talking to, who sees you in the gym, who sees you overseas. One of those things, you never know who's, you know, as we tell our players, you never know who's watching. And it could be one of those things. So in camps, I always continue to work camps. Again, once this started happening, I reached out to you and some of the other local guys. I'd like to do some things with you guys locally now that, you know, that things have kind of opened up in that respect. I don't know, Mike. I never know where it's going to go.
What is a basketball junkie to do, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's what it's all about. I think that, again, your experiences in the game have been so wide-ranging as a coach. I think we'd probably be hard-pressed to find anybody who's had the variety of experiences that you've been able to have, thinking about the high school level, the college level, the professional level, and just getting to be in so many different places and work with so many good people and getting a chance to coach players at all different levels, I'm sure has had to be tremendously rewarding. We're getting close to an hour and a half. So before we wrap things up, I want to give you a chance to let people know where they can find out more about you, how they can reach out to you, get in touch with you. Go ahead and share any of your contact information or social media. And
yeah,
then I'll jump back in and wrap things up.
Okay. On Twitter, you can follow me at CoachinBB. It's CoachinBB, CoachinBB. Instagram, TheCoachA14. I've got a YouTube channel, TheCoachAnderson, which I have some game films up there and also drills and things that I've done over the years. Facebook, unless I meet you personally, I probably won't accept them. I'm a little leery on that one, but once I meet somebody and then they send me a Facebook request, I usually will accept those. So that would be it. I'm on LinkedIn, Mark D. Anderson. I put stuff on there also about that. Most of my social media, actually all of it, yeah, other than Facebook, is basketball or sports.
Yeah, I can relate to that. I don't think I have anything on any social media that anybody who's looking to find out anything about me personally is going to have a hard time doing it on social media. Let's put it that way, Mark. So we will take and we will put all those social media contacts and information in the show notes when we put the episode up for anybody who is trying to furiously scribble that down. And Mark, we can't thank you enough for spending some time with us tonight. I'm really glad that you reached out to me a couple of weeks ago about camp. Unfortunately, at that time, I thought everything was going to be shut down for the entirety of the summer. It looks like now maybe I'll be able to get back and maybe do a couple of weeks of camp here at some point. But I feel very fortunate that you and I were able to make contact and that you were willing to come on and be a guest here on the Hoopheads Pod. It's been a lot of fun getting to know you and find out more about your career. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks. Coaches, we've teamed up with E3 Analytics, so you can now purchase 3 of their exclusive new playbooks. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from Coach Don Showalter of USA Basketball,
Coach Mike Flynn from the Illawarra Hawks in Australia, who coached LaMelo Ball last season, and Coach Tyler Whitcomb from West Michigan Aviation Academy. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.